game The Keys with Lee Prado.
In his own words, Steve Watkins, also known by his stage name Swatkins, is a ginger-bearded, smiley keyboard guy whose music generally sounds like a good time. You may have heard him perform with acts like Alan Stone, Scary Pockets, Wolfpack, Morey Amasa, Turquoise, or even Bernie Worrell, or you may know him for his solo work under both his own name and with his group, The Positive Agenda. No matter how you've heard him, this man's positivity shines through his music, and it's a joy to speak with him. For this first episode of Unlocking the Keys, I had the opportunity to sit with Steve for quite some time, have some fun, share some stories, and of course, hear all about his signature talk box. Hope you enjoy, and please follow Unlocking the Keys wherever you hear podcasts for more episodes just like this, in addition to finding me, Link Bradham, on social media. And now, let's unlock the keys together with Steve Watkins as our guest. Steve Watkins, or as so many of us fans affectionately know you, Swatkins, thank you so much for being a guest on Unlocking the Keys today. Thank you so much for being here. Just want to ask, how's your day going?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, real pleasure to be here. Yeah, everything's good. My day so far is, it's like another sunny day in Los Angeles. Go figure. Yeah.
Yeah, man. And you just had a birthday, right?
Yeah. I was born May 12th. And so like that's 2 days before this interview. And then my partner, Morey Amasa, her birthday is the 10th of May. And so we've just kind of been stretching our celebration to encompass like the full week. So yeah, I'm sort of like, feel like I'm playing catch up here now.
I mean, it's great, man. How great to have that dual celebration. Happy birthday to both of you, and happy birthday to someone we were talking about a little bit before the show here, but happy birthday to Mr. Stevie Wonder as well.
Closest thing we have to a superhero on this planet, yeah. Yeah, he entered the realm on May 13th, so we're adjacent, yeah.
Very cool, like birthday bros, like almost birthday bros. That's awesome. So, Steve, kind of like I was telling you before the show started here, longtime fan myself, a lot of us have been following your work both on social media and the live circuit. I haven't been blessed to see you live yet, but you've played with people such as Alan Stone, Scary Pockets, even Wolfpack. But before all of this, how did you get your start with keyboards and music in general?
So I grew up like in upstate New York, like Capital Region outside Albany. And my dad is a guitar player and just like music aficionado. And so like we growing up, we're just like listening and playing music like all the time, you know. And the first kind of instrument in my hands was like guitar and bass. But I got obsessed with keyboards like pretty quickly too. And, I've been in bands since I was 12 or 13 years old, and like middle school started forming bands with friends. Doesn't matter if you knew how to play, like you could like come be in the band and like learn parts basically. And, I think it's kind of like informed a lot of my approach to the keys, like being like a band guy, and like learning how to use different like sonic palettes. You know, the keys are just like so, like the breadth of tones that you can get with them is kind of unparalleled. And so like learning how to like do like a little cool synth part that makes like the band like sit in the pocket to me is way more interesting than learning like how to cover all 88 keys on the piano. And that stuff's amazing to me, but that's just not how I grew up approaching the keyboard. And so like we were like teaching each other meters tunes, right? And just like learning how to like, okay, like this instrument does like this part, and like you need to like honor that part and like guard it and like keep that groove, keep that pocket. And as I got more into like, I got obsessed with vintage keyboards, I started collecting like electric pianos and synthesizers and stuff when I was in high school and college already. And like just learning the different voices of those instruments and like how to approach them, I think is like really what shaped me as a player. That's kind of like what made me like who I am today. And, you know, I still like, if there's like a situation where it's like, you need to do 10 fingers on the piano keyboard at all time and like a classical thing, I'm still like, I don't really know how to do that. Like that, that aspect of my technique has been deficient, you know, but like, in lieu of that, it's just been like figuring out like sound design and groove and like, how to mesh in a band, you know, that's kind of my bag.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I'm so excited to have you here as a guest on Unlocking the Keys is because here at this podcast, it's all about how can the keys best fit and how can all of the instruments best serve each other, right? I mean, nobody's trying to be a superstar, or if you are, that's cool, but like not around here. It's all just like you said, how can you fit in the pocket? How can you play that one part so well that it's so groovy that if it went anywhere, that the song just wouldn't be the same?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of keyboard players, I think, contend to want to fill up as much space as possible. And it's just like, it's not terribly musical. Like if that's your go-to approach, it's just like it's just not very musical. Like 10 finger chords all the time, it's just like, all right, okay, too much.
It makes me wonder, because you really are like an expert at that pocket playing, just playing that groove that fits so well and just really in that pocket. Did you take lessons, or are you self-taught? Or
yeah, I mostly avoided formal training, didn't go to music school, took like a couple lessons, but more so kind of focused on like, for me, like when I was starting on keys, right, it's like I was coming from a guitar and bass perspective. And so I still really thought like in terms of like what was going on in my left hand, like what's the root, you know, and then how could I build structures around that? And then, you know, kind of develop from there. So like, I remember the first time, you know, like hanging out with people who are formally trained, it's just like, I can sort of peek over their shoulder and be like, hey, like, show me how you voice that chord there. And they're like, okay, all right, kid, sure, no problem. But it's like, but I was, you know, I was afraid of like the academia side of things sort of robbing the like magic of this. For me, when I was a kid, I was like, my crew of friends, like that was like how we hung out with each other, was just like stumbling around in the dark and like figuring out stuff that worked. And like that process to me was just so pure and like special that I kind of didn't want to like codify that and just go through the dogma of music. But at this point, like I know music theory, like I know kind of like what's happening like harmonically and stuff, but my technique is still pretty poor. And it's just like it's really been it's just been shaped through like doing what's needed in the context of a group or whatever. So like having people around you who do know like exactly what they're doing and talking about is like super helpful. And I'm like very grateful to have been surrounded by way more badass individuals than myself. And so I can borrow and steal all their shit, but like, I managed to like avoid most formal training and just kind of like learned it with the band, like with the crew.
You know, it's funny, man. I've gone back and I've watched a lot of your YouTube videos, not just with Scary Pockets, but even, you know, your solo stuff and picked apart some of those keyboard parts, and honestly, a lot of them, man, are fairly complex. So, you know, I definitely think there's a lot to unpack there technically. But even aside from that, I think that lack of formal training, not to sell formal training short by any stretch, a lot of times formal training is exactly what people need, and going to music school and the whole you know, the whole gamut of you know, kind of that gauntlet of formal training. But I think that for some of us who don't have that, that being forced to kind of figure it out kind of, you know, helps us along the journey to stay a little more honest in our playing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain process that you end up engaging with when, like, you're looking for the right answer to something, as opposed to just like, I'm just looking for how to engage with this, right? And it's just like a lot of academia is sort of focused on like, well, you need to know 100% the right thing to do before you do anything, you know? And that's like, that can make a very accomplished player. Like, that can make someone who can play in all 12 keys, they know jazz standards, they know bebop licks, they can do all this stuff, they can play circles. But it sort of like, it front loads that aspect of it. And then it sort of like kicks the can down the road as far as like developing your own authentic voice, you know? And it's not to say you can't have both, but if technique is like the first thing that you need to master before you then go on to develop your voice, it's just like, I think it ends up stunting some players, and they want to know 100% that what they're doing is killing all of the time. And it's just like, if that's the goal, then like, you're not probably going to play anything exciting, because like, you already know 100% of the time, here's my Charlie Parker shit. Here's, you know, like whatever it is. And so, yeah, like, not that I'm recommending like just like fumbling around like I did, but like that kind of front loaded the experience of like finding stuff that works for you, you know? And so that was my first door into like how to play keys. And it was not just like play in all 12 keys, learn your modes. It was none of that stuff. It was just like, how can you make this song better with like a keyboard part?
And I think that's really apparent in a lot of your work. I'm curious, man, who are some of like your influences, like your formative influences?
So when I was a kid, my dad would play a lot of stuff from like his college days. So like his favorite band in college was Sly and the Family Stone. So we went deep into Sly. We did, you know, Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, Donny Hathaway, Stevie Wonder for sure, like all the classic like soul and R&B stuff. And my dad was really into Dylan and the Band too. He was super obsessed with that stuff. And so we had all those records, all those tapes. Like he was also into like Antonio Carlos Jobim and João Gilberto and the Brazilian Cats. And so like just like listening to his tapes and records was like a huge kind of background knowledge for me. And then like as I started listening to hip hop, like when I was a kid, the first like contemporary music I was really obsessed with was hip hop. And I started like hearing these things, was like, I think that's like a Blue Note, like maybe that's like Herbie Hancock, maybe that's like something, and would go kind of like start to connect those dots and figure out like how deep that language was, you know? And that's kind of like what got me into thinking about different ways to bridge, you know, styles, genres, generations of music and try to incorporate something that like, that sounds authentic, something that sounds like a voice that you could deploy in a band, you know, in a band context. And so like, I think like, you know, Herbie Hancock was like a keyboard hero when I was in high school for sure. And just like, we would listen to Thrust like over and over again. And then I checked out Soul Live in the late 90s, like when they were just first starting to be a band, and their organ player, Neil Evans, has this incredible left-hand bass technique. And so it's like a trio, it's like an organ trio, guitar, bass, or guitar, drums, and then organ, and like doing keyboard bass. And so it's like the same format as like a classic Grant Green, you know, or a Boogaloo like organ trio, but they're doing like hip hop influenced stuff and more R&B. And that really, really messed me up when I was a kid. It was just like, oh, because we were just starting to play with synth bass, and my friends had a Suitcase Rhodes, and would put a Juno on top of it and like do like bass with the left hand and then play the Rhodes. And so we were just kind of figuring out how to do that format. And then we saw a Soul Live. We were just like, oh my God. Like, I couldn't believe like how locked the rhythm was. And then they could still shred and solo and all this stuff on top of it. So that really turned me around too when I was a kid.
Definitely. And I'm kind of blown away by a lot of the parallels, because like, kind of similar to you, my dad had this kind of crazy record collection, you know, like lots of old classic rock and like, you know, 50s and 60s and a bunch of stuff like that. And, you know, then the first, you know, music I kind of went off and explored on my own was similar to you, also hip hop. And it's funny, I'm realizing now, I never really heard it or realized before, but you know, a lot of your music has a lot of hip hop influence in it. And so you know, I'm excited to go back and kind of listen with that sort of ear, but also want to ask you know, who were some of your early hip hop influences, because I never knew that about you. That's such a cool thing, man.
So like the record that I probably wore out when I was in high school was Midnight Marauders by Tribe Called Quest. Also 3 Feet High and Rising, De La Soul. Like by the time I was into college, I got really into the Black Star record, the Mos Def Talib Kweli record, and also the High Tech Talib record. And the roots were like, I was like obsessed with the Roots. I thought like, the first couple times I listened to that Roots Come Alive record, I was just like, this, like, I want to make music like this. Like, this is so like authentic and organic and like just deep, just really deep and like present. You could tell that they were making everything like right there on the spot, like no tricks, nothing like hidden. They're just like doing it. And that was really, really impressive to me. I was just like, okay, like as cool as like listening to a well-produced record and like all of the headphone tricks and effects and all that stuff is cool. And I really love that music. There's something that's like undeniable about a live presentation. Like, you know, that everything that you're hearing is by being done by a person at the same time. And that's really cool. And not the normal case with hip hop. So.
Yeah. And it was like, you know, a completely new sound. And, you know, it's actually a really great segue into the next question I had for you, which, you know, as far as new sounds go, when people think of like one of the best live albums of all time, I think a lot of people immediately think, you know, Peter Frampton Comes Alive. And I think you might know where this is going, but, you know, people think of that new sound at the time being the Talk Box. And, you know, he was kind of the original Talkbox hero, but the Talkbox has a new hero in town, a man by the name of Mr. Steve Swatkins. And, I'm just curious, man, as I'm sure many of your fans are, how'd you get the start with the Talkbox?
Oh, do you feel like I do? Yeah. Do you feel like I do?
Man. Yeah, Frampton, that's like probably the most referenced Talkbox hero, for sure. Yeah.
Dude, his guitar is talking.
But I don't know. I think I first got into it from like the vocoder side of things. There's this Herbie record called Sunlight, where he like does a lot of vocoder, and it's you know, it's like a very different texture than the Talk Box. Like, I'd say like they're similar, right? And it's just like people sort of use them interchangeably, but they're actually like different, pretty different effects. And so like the vocoder on Sunlight is like this like gauzy, really like soft and like silky texture. And it kind of sounds like Herbie's voice, and it's like, it's pretty, you know? And like the Talk Box is like aggressive and like distorted and like funky, you know? And so like when I first started, I had a Juno and I would run it through a vocoder, and do more kind of like textural, like patty stuff with it, and like use the vocoder to shape the envelope of the sound to almost like do like a wah-wah instead of like speech, right? But the couple times I would mess with doing like a lead sound on the vocoder, I was just like, there's like, it's not like present. It's not like as in your face as I wanted it to be. And the thing that really changed it for me was like getting deep into Zapp and Roger Troutman. Cause like, you know, their connection to Bootsy and George Clinton in the P-Funk in the 70s era and like the 80s. And then also their connection to G-Funk and like California Love and Snoop and Dre and Tupac and all that stuff. Like, I was like, oh, there's something about this that's like, it's just, it's so immediate. And like Roger would used to talk about people getting like hypnotized. Like when he would be doing the talk box, like people would just be like, what? Like, what is that? And I totally identify that. Like when I was younger and we're playing in like cover bands and bars, you know, it's just like I would bust out the talk box and then everyone would just be like, yo. Yeah. It's just like, it's really like, it's like a parlor trick in a way. So it's like, but it's also just like a really legitimate solo voice, you know? And so for people who don't know, it's like, it's literally like a small speaker in a box and you plug your synthesizer into it. And then the sound comes through the speaker and shoots through the tube. So it looks like I'm singing into it
when I'm doing the talk box,
but it's shooting sound into my mouth and then I'm shaping it around it. So it's like, if you're watching what my mouth is doing, like without the tube in it, but then when you do this,
make this sound with my mouth to make my keyboard talk. Yes, yes, I can.
And so like, it just like, it's absurd. It's like, it really is like a hybrid between like what your mouth and throat and like palate would be doing just without the vocal cords. So like all of the pitch information and everything is coming from like you playing it. That's the talk box.
Yeah, man. You know, just like you said, the talk box itself, it doesn't really have any of the actual, like, you know, pitch information, but do you traditionally sing as well? Or
I do, yeah. And it's like on the Positive Agenda EP, there's a tune where I'm like singing with my human voice, right? And then like I get kind of like so excited that like the talk box takes over, you know.
You know, it's funny because, you know, leading up to the show, I've been going back through everybody's catalog who is going to be a guest on Unlocking the Keys. And I remember listening to that track and being like, is that Steve? Is that Steve's real singing voice? Or is that like some session guy that they brought in? Like, I wasn't sure. So I was like, I got to ask Steve when he gets on the show. So thanks for clearing that up.
That's me on Feels Good to Feel Good. And like it's me singing on Got to Give It Away If You're Going to Keep It.
So I only have myself to blame. Yeah, yeah. You got to give it away if you're gonna keep it. Gonna keep it. There's a number of songs you believe it. If you can give it down, I know someone who needs it. You got to give it away
Yeah, cool. You know, it's interesting. You talk about that dynamic between, you know, seeing the audience get so excited when you bring out the talk box. And when live music, you know, comes back, it'll be really cool to see that, you know, that dichotomy of between the real voice and the robot voice.
Totally. Yeah. That's part of it too. Is because, like, you know, as fun and expressive as the talk box is, it's also just like tonally, it kind of just does that one thing. And so, like, even if you're like a huge fan of the talk box, which not everybody is, it's not for everybody, that's okay. But even if you love it, it's just like a whole show of just talk box is like fatiguing to the ear, basically. So
yeah, definitely a lot of like harmonic information, like high frequency information happening there, that, you know, I could definitely see how, you know, it's fun to listen to for a while, but an entire show of just talk box might take a special kind of listener. But yeah, man, last little bit on the talk box, you know, you go on YouTube and you see all of these different talk box shootouts and everything. And I'm curious, what is Steve Swatkin's preferred weapon of choice when it comes to the talk box? You know, there's like the MXR 222 and a few of the different other ones. What is your preferred talk box of choice?
Yeah, I have like three or four of these guys. That's the MXR. I used to use the Banshee, the Rocktron Banshee, and I just kept busting them. And I would, like, you know, it's not like I was treating them like with, like, I would like kick a beer and it was like, oh, this thing's broke. Like, but these, like, they're just like slightly more compact and durable. They do the same thing. You know what I mean? It's just like, like, people are looking for like the highest fidelity boutique talk box. And I was like, no, it's like, it's just a little distorted speaker in a box. There's nothing fancy or boutique about it. But this one, it's just like, it's small, it's compact. Like, I just like have a harder time breaking them than other ones. So that's the one I've been using.
Yeah, man. I mean, durability is such a thing in the life of the modern gigging musician, especially as things have gotten more and more digitized and like less about, you know, being built to last a lifetime, like, you know, the old like Hammond B3s and stuff like that. You know, stuff just breaks down. But aside from that, you know, anybody who hasn't already checked you out on all of the social media and all of these things, definitely check out, you know, Steve, because he's really kind of a modern trailblazer for a lot of us keyboardists.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, it's from the heart. I'm sure it's true not just for me, but for many others. You know, you inspire a lot of us. And speaking of, you know, inspiration and experiences from the heart, what would you say, if you could pick just one or maybe a couple of your most rewarding experiences musically thus far, what would you say that is?
Man, like, for me personally, it's, I think, like, I don't want to get too like spiritual or whatever, but it's like, it feels like the thing that's actually helped me out the most is being at peace with who I am. And that, like, that's both me as a musician and just me as a flawed, beautiful human being. Like, I spent a lot of my earlier years kind of like playing comparison games, right? And like thinking about like, well, you know, here's the ways in which I'm not as good a keys player as I wish I could be, or here are the ways in which the world has been unfair to me, or I feel like I don't have the opportunities that I should, or beating myself up for neglecting certain aspects of my playing. So when it would come up on a gig and it'd be like, hey, can you do this sort of thing? I'd be like, oh, like, no, that's like a weak spot for me. Shit, you know, and just like beating myself up and just wishing that I was something that I'm not, you know? And I think that I think that like achievements, like as far as getting a good gig, like when Alan Stone hired me for the first time, I was just like, oh, like this is really cool. That feels good. Or like playing a big show, playing Red Rocks or playing like the Apollo Theater or something. It's just like, that feels really good, but it doesn't change your like inner critic unless you let it, you know? And it's just like, you don't need any of that stuff. But what you do need to do is like be all right with who you are. It's just like music is so pure and so beautiful. And it's just like, it's been there for longer than we have. It's going to be there long after we're gone. If you can cultivate a relationship with this thing that allows you to feel good, then that's like, that's success. It's not the gig. It's not the who you play with. It's not the Grammy. It's just like, it's knowing that that shit is there for you always, no matter what. And no one can take it away, but you can get in your own way and like block yourself from receiving that, like that thing. And it's just like, I honestly believe that music has like basically like made me who I am. Like I owe my life to this thing. And so I want to approach it respectfully and like with reverence. And that's part of that is just like taking away the ego, the brain that's just like, hey, like what do you need in order to feel okay with this? And it's just like, you don't really need any of that. Like what you need to do is like accept that music is beautiful and it's a privilege to just like hang out with music and get to do it. Like that's the best shit ever.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Wow. I mean, that's the reward right there. Man, wise words. Thank you so much for sharing that. Because, man, I feel like a lot of times aspiring musicians, myself included, we can, you know, think that the next step is to get to, you know, the next level gig or to have the best chops ever. And you can get there, but you get there and then you might still not have what you need in here. And then, you know, I think that's what a lot of us, at least myself, you know, I can say, hear and see in your music and the way you present yourself, you know, you kind of, it's, you're bringing this positive agenda about how, you know, music is just like you described this beautiful sacred thing. And, you know, moving a little more towards kind of the keyboard, you know, maybe keyboard education side of things. When it comes to musicians of different instruments, what kinds of things do you think we can learn from other musicians of other instruments or keyboards included?
Man, I mean, like the number one thing, I don't really have a ton of keyboard students, you know what I mean? And like part of that is just like me being selective. And then part of it is just like that, my ability to like, to teach in a formal setting is somewhat limited by my experience. And so, the students I end up taking are mostly like already intermediate to advanced players. And they're just looking for like either like a sort of coaching, like reframing their perspective of how they're approaching the instrument, or like a very specific, like, how do you do the bendy technique with the left hand? Cause I'm a piano player and I don't play synth, you know? And so like what I tell all my students, regardless of how they came to me or like what they're looking to achieve, I was just like, yo, you should sit down at a drum kit, like a couple of times a month, if you can, or like, if you don't have a drum kit, you can literally just do it in your throne and like drum on your hands, but put on a metronome, you know, and then just, and then bury the click. Just, you do that for like 45 minutes a week, you'll get better at every other aspect of like musicianship that there is. And it's like, it's so simple. And there's no magic to it. It's literally like you just put yourself in the drum throne, and then everything about your musicality will improve. It's just like your singing gets better if you like sit down at the drums like once a week. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that rhythm aspect, right?
It's just how to place your notes. And again, because keyboard players, like, the physical production of the note is you just press a button, you know? So there's no breath, there's no string vibrating like under your finger, there's no like battery involved. It's you just press the button and then your tone is produced. So we're sort of like divorced from physicality in a way that other band members are more intimate with. And so our tendency is to rush because there's like fewer physical consequences for playing a note. You don't have to conserve as much energy or think about like where the pocket falls, like when you're just pressing buttons. But you sit at the drums and you're like, every motion has rhythm, you know? And like, if you can translate that to how you're playing, it's just like everything gets more cohesive internally. And then it also is easier to mesh and blend with the other elements of the groove.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's a really interesting technique. And I wonder how often us musicians, at least, you know, if we consider ourselves to be primarily musicians of one instrument, pick up those other instruments just to kind of see, you know. It's funny, I've got a drum kit downstairs that I haven't played in probably 3 or 4 months with any sense of regularity, and now I feel like I'm gonna go down and start shedding.
And like, I see you got like guitars and basses on your wall too, and like every teacher will tell you to like sing your parts. So like if you're just playing scales or whatever, just sing them, like feel like what it does to like your body to produce those notes. Because like, again, it's just like when all you're doing is like clink and then there's your tone, there's not as much weight behind it. But like you're singing it and you're like, oh wow, like an octave is like a far jump. Like there's a lot of space in that octave. And on the keyboard, you're just like, hey, look at me, baby. Like, it's just like that. You can just lay it down. And so like, again, it's like understanding the consequences of what you're playing and just like how that can affect people. Like if you're Shreddy Krueger, Shreddy Mercury all over the keyboard 100% of the time, it's not effective. Like people aren't going to receive that information. You got to temper that.
Yes, sir. You know, when it comes to choosing, you know, keyboard sounds, like between like, you know, maybe some of the classic vintage sounds, like, you know, the Rhodes or the Whirly or Clav or B3, you know, or even like, you know, maybe a synth sound or whatever. How do you go about choosing those sounds personally? Like, what do you find works for you, or where do you draw inspiration from?
Yeah, it totally depends, right? It's like sometimes there's a sound or just a feeling that's like so present from the moment that you come up with an idea that you're like, okay, this is clearly a Rhodes part, you know? But other times it's like, it's literally just a choice, you know, it's a choice you make and you need to trust your ears. And so I'm guilty of this too, where I'll sort of get married to my demo. And like, it was just like, okay, so I used a Rhodes in the demo, like I really love how it sounds. And then I'm not even really like considering an alternative, but the producer or like the engineer or like a co-writer will just be like, hey, let's just try it on Wurlitzer. And it's just like, oh, like that's like that. We should have done that from the beginning. But like, if we didn't allow ourselves to change our mind, then, you know, then it's kind of like, why are we even dicking around in the studio? You could just finish it in the demo and then be done with it. But, I think in general, like with keys, again, it's just like, there's, for those of us who are in like, gigging kind of corporate bands or like cover bands or wedding bands, it's just like, the keyboard players are expected to be responsible for such a broad set of sounds. You need to cover piano, organ, Rhodes, Whirly, Clav, synth, strings, horns. Like you got to be able to do Motown and disco and pop and rock and blues and all this stuff. And like, it's just like most keyboards, like aside from a Nord or a Motif or like a Swiss Army do it, everything. It's just like, they don't you're not going to be able to cover literally every sound that keyboards have ever made, you know? And so it's about choices, and like, and limiting your choices can actually be expanding of creativity. You know, if you have every option, how many of us have like downloaded a VST or like a software synth and then spent like an hour scrolling presets? You're like, well, these all sound shitty. If you took that hour and just like learned how to make a sound just for yourself, you'd probably be way happier with it anyway, and then like find a use for it. And so having a million presets and a million choices is not necessarily going to help you creatively. It's like, it's literally, you need to trust your ears in the same way that like, as we're developing as players, like the, before our technique catches up, our ears are already ahead of it. So it's just like when we're stuck in like a critical mode, we're like, oh, like nothing I play like sounds the way I want it to sound. And then people get discouraged and like quit or just get frustrated. And it's just like, that's a necessary part of it. Like your ears need to be ahead of your fingers or else you'll never get better. Like you need to recognize like what you want to change in order to work on changing it. Otherwise, it's just like you play your same blues licks that you've played a million times and just never improve. You'll never get out of that rut.
Yeah, man. It's like, you know, I hear it coming up more and more, especially in like YouTube, like online master classes, or like even like there's a gentleman by the name of Michael Palmisano, who really, really amazing teacher on YouTube, who's going to be another guest on Unlocking the Keys this season. And he talked about one time just limiting yourself to 3 frets, right, on the guitar. Like you can play, you know, do a solo, do a full 24 bar solo using just 3 frets. You know, you can bend as much as you want, but just limit to those 3 frets. Or like I had a keyboard teacher some time back who he was like, dude, I want you to play a solo using just 1 note.
Yes.
1 note, nothing else. And it's like, you know, when you've got 1 note, what have you got? Like you've got dynamics, you've got rhythm, and you've got that 1 note and like nothing else. So it's like, you know, sometimes when you limit yourself, it allows you to like unlock that creativity, you know, unlock the keys to branching out even further. And so, yeah, man, we're kind of moving towards the end of our time together here today. And one thing I want to ask that I plan on asking all of the guests on Unlocking the Keys is if you could offer one piece of advice to aspiring musicians, young or old, what would it be?
I think it's good to remember that music is supposed to be fun, like if you want it to be. You know, it's just like this is kind of circling back to what we were talking about before a little bit, but I think it bears repeating. It's literally like it's one of the greatest things that humans can access. And too often I feel people, especially when they're starting, but this happens at every point along a journey through a life of music, is that we end up like using it to like torture ourselves in a way and just like be hypercritical, playing the comparison game. Like, why do they have these opportunities? Why is she able to play this way and I'm not able to play this way? And how poorly does this reflect on me? So if like, if there's one piece of advice, it's just like, it can be a source of joy for the rest of your life. If you cultivate that relationship with it, it's just like, I see a lot of people just kind of like committing self-harm in a way through their relationship with music. And just like, they're literally beating themselves up inside over their perceived deficiencies or lacks. And it's just like, you are so lucky just to get to sit down and play your instrument. Like any day that you get to sit down and play your instrument is a good fucking day.
So true. It's so true. Thank you. The truth there is in the simplicity. And you know, it's real easy to think that just sitting down to play an instrument is such a simple thing, and it is, but at the same time, it's like it's totally not. And it's such a blessing to be reminded to, you know, to try to keep things a little simple.
Feels good to feel good, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, once again, great segue. For those who don't already know, we heard a snippet of It Feels Good to Feel Good, which is a track of Swatkins off of his Positive Agenda EP, which you can check out, pretty sure on all streaming services. But actually, yeah, man, want to give you an opportunity to plug all things Steve, you know, Steve Watkins, anything you've got upcoming that you want us to be aware of. How can people stay up to date on all things Swatkins?
Absolutely, yeah. The next Swatkins record is like almost done from my end. Of course, there's still going to be a delay before I get to like share it with you, but like I'm almost done with my portion of the work. So I'm really excited about that to release it. And I'll be posting about it on social media. I just launched my Patreon, which for those of you who are unfamiliar, it's a platform that encourages music fans to engage with and directly support artists that they care about. So normally fans are able to stream a song. If they really, really like the artist, they'll buy the record, maybe buy some merch at the show. And then they're kind of out of ways to support their favorite artist. They spent $80 or whatever, did all the things that are available. And then that's kind of it. And then Patreon sort of cuts out the middleman. It lets you interact directly with your supporters. And so what I'm asking people to do is as they sign up for this program is to like, let me know what they would like. So if they want more Talkbox tutorials, if they want production techniques, if they want keyboard and sound design tips, they can let me know. And then I can sort of offer that to them directly. And we engage in this, like, in like our own community, like our chosen family kind of relationship. So I've been starting with that stuff, and that's been really cool. A bunch of people have been signing up, and we're going to start doing some live streams and other fun stuff there. My partner, Maria Massa, just put out a record called Heart in the Wild. She's releasing it in two parts. The first side just came out, and I'm co-writing and playing and producing on those tracks. We're really, really proud of that record. And there's going to be more stuff coming, man. It's just like, since moving down to LA, I'm living at the spot Blue Dream Studios, which is run by Raquel Rodriguez, a fantastic artist, and her partner, Sam Bronner. And we've been like writing and producing and doing music videos and all this stuff. So there's going to be a lot more stuff coming out soon. I can't wait to share it with you guys.
Cool, man. And, we can't wait. And once again, thank you so much, so very much for being a guest on the show. And when it comes to the Patreon or anything else, people can just search Swatkins or what's best.
My artist name or whatever is Swatkins, you know, so it's like, so that's how I'm linked on Spotify. And you can find me on Patreon just by searching Swatkins. Yeah.
And you and your partner's record, how can people find that?
Her name is Maria Massa. That's MOOREAMASA, Maria Massa. And the record's called Heart in the Wild. It's the brand new record.
So excited to hear it. And once again, man, thank you so much for reminding us all to, you know, keep it simple and stay positive and have fun.
Yeah, this is a blast, man. Appreciate you. Keep up the good work.
Unlocking the keys with Steve Swatkins. Yes, we are. Unlocking the keys. Yes, unlocking the keys with Steve Swatkins. Oh, yes.
And there you have it. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Steve Swatkins, also known as Swatkins. A truly amazing, beautiful, and inspiring soul. Since this interview, Steve has built up his Patreon. Go ahead and check it out. And his next album comes out soon. And you can also catch him opening up for the amazing group Lawrence in Texas and Colorado through November 2021, with tour dates listed on swatkinsmusic.com. As always, thank you for listening, and please follow Unlocking the Keys wherever you hear podcasts for more episodes just like this, in addition to following me, Link Bradham, on social media. I hope you have a truly lovely day, evening, or whatever time frame you might find yourself in the present moment. Peace.